next case on the court's en banc calendar is Las Vegas Sands Corporation et al. Versus 8th Judicial District Court of Stephen Jacobs, real party in interest, 69802. Are you ready to proceed?
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, I want to begin with the uncontested facts in this case. It was Judge Gonzalez who made initial contact with the press. She approached the Las Vegas Review-Journal reporter and asked him why he was in the courtroom. She then received extrajudicial information, which was prejudicial, from the reporter. Quote, the boss said, I had to be here. Then she voluntarily decided to recount this dialogue on the record to a reporter from Time Magazine, who she knew was writing an article about a litigant in a case before her, namely Sheldon Adelson, and about a subject, namely his alleged purpose in Las Vegas Review-Journal, that the judge ruled may be relevant in the case before her. She had to have at least reasonably suspected that the article would deal critically with the newspaper purchase, and yet she volunteered to give an on-the-record quotation for use in the article, and you can see it right there in that mock-up, including the boss said I had to be here. The entire predictably result of the case, of this encounter, was that a major article with a picture of the judge that featured her quotation and that gave judicial imprimatur to the entire content of the article. The article ended up being very flattering to the judge and very unflattering to the litigant. And the judge had to know that her interviews would give rise to a motion for disqualification, and that's why she had witnesses to the conversation. She said, I had witnesses to the conversations for a reason. As the First Circuit said in a very similar case, when a judge engages in, quote, expressive conduct in deliberately making the choice to make public comments to the press regarding a pending case, she invites trouble. Choosing to speak to the press for an article about a litigant before her and a pending case, which is the subject of the article that was deemed relevant, is at least particularly unwise. The judge in that case was one of the most distinguished judges in the federal court, Judge Nancy Gertner, now serving as a professor at Harvard Law School. There was not criticism directed necessarily at the judge, but the court ruled that the appearance of impropriety,
Mr. Judicious, my question would be is, assuming for sake of argument we agreed with you on these various points, this was heard by the District Court Chief Judge David Barker. He heard all this, he analyzed it, and our standard review, I believe, is abuse of discretion. Can you comment on that?
It's not abuse of discretion. We think there are two standards of review here. Number one, there are uncontested facts here, and what we're asking for is an application of the law, number one. Number two, he didn't hear anything. Literally didn't hear anything. The statute says hear, heard. He simply reviewed the affidavit of the judge and the pleadings and said, I don't have to hear anything. And he ruled against us by simply reiterating, in his opinion, what she had said in her affidavit and accepting everything is true. We then submitted briefs which argued that no, we don't think what she said was accurate. We want to have a hearing. We introduced an affidavit from a distinguished ethics expert and asked for an opportunity to be heard. And so the two issues in this case are, number one, whether the facts as they are undisputed, you can't dispute the Time Magazine article, you can't dispute the quotes in the article, whether the facts alone give rise to a basis for disqualification, and if not, whether the judge applied the right procedure in not allowing us to have counter affidavits, not allowing us to have a hearing, not allowing us to question witnesses. After all, there were witnesses. She purposely created a situation where she had witnesses to what she said. Now, we don't know what was said back and forth. There's a very important case in the Southern District of Florida where the court says conversations are not monographs. They're not one way. They go both ways. And we know things were said back and forth. We know she said things to the journalist because they're quoted. We know that journalists said things to her because they're quoted. We don't know what else may have been said. And she received extrajudicial information that she would not otherwise have received, and then she transmitted that extrajudicial information. Now, the key point here is this. Anyone with experience in the media knows that when a judge is interviewed for an article, everything else in the article is given a judicial imprimatur, is given gravitas. It doesn't matter that she said, I can't tell you whether I serve M&Ms to Sheldon Adelson. That doesn't matter. The point is she was quoted on the record in the article. And anyone with experience in the media knows that the media over and over again tells people, we can't run this story unless we get a direct quote from X. In this case, X was the judge. That story probably never would have been run at all if they didn't have a direct quotation from the judge, which is why the courts have said that, quote, even ambiguous comments may create the appearance of impropriety. Here her statements included the recounting, the boss said, I had to be here. Nothing ambiguous about that. And that's why also good judges know that they should not say anything to the media that would likely result in a motion to disqualify. And that's why Rule 2110A provides that a judge shall not make any public statement that might reasonably be expected to impair the fairness of a matter pending. And this is especially so in cases that the courts have described as highly idiosyncratic. In the First Circuit case, it said, in newsworthy cases where tensions may be high, judges should be particularly cautious about commenting on pending litigation. I can imagine no case in this state that has been more contentious or more closely watched by the media or more idiosyncratic than this case. The judge herself commented over and over again that this case has received massive media attention, which is why she had to have special procedures when she calls the jury. The judge had to know that her voluntary interview with the media would be regarded by the movement as the straw that broke the camel's back. A final disqualifying act in a case in which prior motions regarding her conduct had been made and denied. She should have known that she was inviting trouble, that her decision to initiate contact with the media was, quote, at the very least particularly unwise, and that it would give rise to a motion for disqualification. She also ought to have known that her interview risked violating Rule 210A. A judge talking to journalists also constitutes the taking of extrajudicial sources. As the United States District Court in Florida said, interviews are not merely one-way streets. Now, what are we asking this court for? We're asking this court for an interpretation of Rule 210A that would best serve the interests of justice. We're not asking for a new rule, but for an interpretation consistent with practices in the state of Nevada. And we're asking for a ruling by this court prohibiting a judge from making any public statement for an article about a litigant in a case before her. That's a simple rule, easy to apply. We believe that such a statement poses too high a risk that might reasonably be expected to impair the fairness in a matter pending. There would be no downside to such a blanket rule. Why? Because in practice, it would not impose a new rule. Today, judges in Nevada don't make public statements that they know will be included in an article about litigants in cases pending before them. It's just not done. And it's not done by good judges anywhere in the United States.
So, Judge Dershowitz, none of this was tested, in your opinion, by the review of the chief judge?
No, there was no review by the judge. He simply reiterated what she said in her affidavit. He never discussed any of these issues. All he did was say, if a judge says she shouldn't be recused, there's a strong presumption she couldn't be recused. If a judge issues an affidavit, there's a strong presumption the affidavit should be believed. He never considered the issue of what impact her being quoted on the record had in giving imprimatur, in giving gravitas to an article. And he never considered whether or not it would be best to have a rule prohibiting any such statement. Your Honor, consider the downside. What is the downside of a rule that you would announce saying, simple rule, if you're asked to comment about a case or a litigant before you, the answer must be no comment. You can't try to work around that rule by saying, well, let me tell you what happened. I spoke to a journalist in the courtroom. I asked the journalist why you're here. And the journalist told me something very interesting. He told me the boss sent me. You know who the boss is. Obviously, Time Magazine knew who the boss was. What's the downside in prohibiting any judge from making comments about a pending litigation or a pending litigant?
Well, did that apply to a procedural thing? Like I say, I walked out the door and a reporter came up to me and said, was talking about this case, maybe it happened yesterday, and said, well, what time's that argument on the Las Vegas Sands case tomorrow or something like, can I have any type of communication?
Well, the best answer is, please talk to the court officers. Please talk to the clerk's office. They can give you all this information. You want to know about our pro bono activities, which is what Judge Gonzalez said she was talking about, talk to the court clerks. Mm-hmm. But the one thing, if you walk out of this courtroom and somebody says to you, we're writing an article about this.
Excuse me.
Yes,
what's your advocate for the plaintiff here? Strips the court, the judge, of all human conditions as you're getting into your argument. I understand you're arguing this for your client, but as I'm listening to you, I'm listening to what occurred and what has been occurred. A motion is made to disqualify a judge.
Right.
Pleadings were presented, correct? You don't disagree with that.
Pleadings and an affidavit.
Right. And then an affidavit was submitted by the judge.
Right.
Like things that are decided quite often, without a hearing, you have a decision by the court. So I understand your position. We should have had an evidentiary hearing, but papers were submitted, a decision was made. I'm listening to you talk, and I'm going to say, if we go the route you're going, should we then require an affidavit by the attorney that they're making it in good faith and everything else, or should we look at potential Rule 11 sanctions if we deem it frivolous? That's the concern I get when you make it so one-sided.
Well, Your Honor, it's exactly...
It disturbs me. It disturbs me the normalcy, and there is a amount of normalcy unless you have specific comments as the pending litigation. And so the comment in terms of why you're here, because we looked around and said, okay, I got a report in the courtroom, it's a slow day. Why are you here? Because I got nothing motions on. I think that was the gist of what was said. And the response was, the boss sent me.
Yep.
Whoever the boss was, and without going through the chronology of when the paper was saved, when it was disclosed, who it was saved to, when this comment was made, which I don't have in front of me, I have some concerns about the timing. But nonetheless, the boss, that was the end of it. Except for it was then published, but it did not talk about the litigation.
Right.
As you said, the only comment, the boss, means it talked about the litigation. Did it plus or minus the litigation?
With all due respect, Your Honor, that simply misunderstands the dynamic of how the media works.
Mr. Dershowitz, I'm saying what I'm saying because I hear what you're saying.
I understand.
And hopefully you've heard what I said.
I have completely heard what you said, Your Honor.
Because you were then, you started to categorize what I was thinking, and that, I think, is inappropriate.
But Your Honor, I'm not trying to you. Believe me, I understand what you're thinking, and I agree with the goal that you have in mind. I think the best way to reach that goal is for this court to send a clear message. Err on the side of never talking to the press about an article that will be about a litigant. That's a clear rule. If you set out that rule, you won't need affidavits, you won't need hearings, because judges will obey your court order. Right now, there's
a statement made by the judge as to any particular outcome or motion or activity in this pending matter.
That's not what the rule says.
That was my question. Would you answer my question?
Your Honor, I don't have to answer the question. The question
you don't have to answer the question.
The answer speaks for itself. It's right there. You can read it as well as I can. She did not talk about the pending litigation, but she gave an imprimatur by being interviewed in an article about a litigant that talked about the pending litigation. And I'm saying that should be prohibited by this court.
Stated that she didn't talk about the litigation.
Your Honor, you cannot talk about something. Let's assume you're interviewed about an article that you know is going to be about this case, and you know it's going to be critical about this case, and you start talking about Sheldon Adelson, not about the case, but about Sheldon Adelson. What you're doing, Your Honor, is contributing to an atmosphere which produces an appearance of prejudice. And it's so easy to stop that. All you have to do, Your Honor, is set out a rule that says clearly, not only must you not talk about the litigation, you must not talk about the litigant,
and he must not be interviewed for an article that's going to be about the litigant and the litigation. Don't split hairs. If you start splitting hairs, as the First Circuit said, you're inviting trouble. And what I would ask a rhetorical question, because I'm not going to ask you questions, is what's the downside? What's the harm? Why should a judge ever be interviewed by Time Magazine about a matter that she knows and has deemed relevant, namely the purchase of newspapers? She's deemed it relevant. She threatened to debar a lawyer because he said it wasn't relevant. What possible downside can this court imagine by having a clear rule that says you don't talk about the litigant, you don't talk about the litigation, you don't give an interview for an article that you know is going to be critical of a litigant before your court because the public might interpret that as showing bias, showing that you put your own interests, getting a good article, before the interests of the litigant who is getting a negative article. So, Your Honor, I've used up my time, but I think there's absolutely no downside in having such a rule, and it will help the people and justice in the state of Nevada. And other judges comply with that rule already today, and so there's no downside in construing the statute to prohibit what was done in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bice, I know you're going to have a lot of issues you want to go into in response here. I just have one question. Perhaps you could describe the nature of the proceedings before Judge Barker. Mr. Dershowitz is indicating you were abbreviated and you really didn't get to delve into this with much significance. What's your perspective on that?
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, and Todd Bice on behalf of Mr. Jacobs. Justice Gibbons, Judge Barker followed the procedure that this Court has applied historically, and including in the Rivero decision that this Court issued in 2009, and that is that the motion was made, and I'll get to some of the facts that are contrary to what has been presented today. A motion was made, and notably, this 210A argument that you're hearing is you are hearing it for the first time, because it wasn't presented in the motion to Judge Barker. It wasn't even argued in their brief to this Court. You're hearing that for the first time today. What Judge Barker did is Judge Barker got the motion. We filed a motion to strike because it was based upon an affidavit under the statute, which was inappropriate, because they then used the statute to then claim that the case was frozen, and that the district court, despite the fact that the district court had been presiding on this case for 5+ years, that the case is frozen, and they did it again after the reconsideration issue, and they have effectively frozen the case again through this maneuvering. So what Judge Barker did was the motion was filed. We filed our motion to strike. He considered that motion. The judge had filed a declaration in response to the declaration of counsel that was submitted, and he decided the motion. There was absolutely no disqualifying facts ever alleged in that motion.
Was there a hearing on this?
It was done as a submitted matter. But as this Court said in Rivera, in fact, these sorts of motions should be summarily disposed of if, in fact, there is no disqualification, basis for disqualification set forth on the face of the motion. And that, by the way, Judge Barker didn't even treat it as that way, but he certainly could have, and in my opinion, should have, because it was frivolous on its face.
Mr. Bice,
yes,
just as a hearing requested in this, and would it have been a better practice to allow them to at least request and the court can grant or deny the hearing as well?
Justice Douglas, the answer to that is no. Let me clarify that. I believe that they did request in their reconsideration, they requested a, quote, oral hearing, all right? But the answer, Justice Douglas, is would it be better practice? No, and it wouldn't be, because this case exemplifies why it wouldn't be better practice. Because then you have the litigants who have an agenda of delay and obstruction to use this as a tool to accomplish those ends, and that is exactly what they have done. And that is exactly what they intended it to do. And it has been successful. Just like all the other bad conduct, unethical conduct that has transpired in this case, that the district judge has found and that you have sustained findings on, was successful. Because this case is now on its nearly 6 years old, and there has been no trial.
And you know why that has happened? It has happened because this litigant, we have a litigant with unlimited resources. So in that brief, they say to you that the public's confidence in the fairness of the judicial process is at issue in this case. And they're right. On that point, I will agree with them. That is exactly what is at issue in this case. Because we have a litigant that is so belligerent and will make any argument and will engage in conduct that has been outlined in multiple findings by the district court to obstruct the search for the truth, and that is all that has been going on. And this argument about this article I find so amusing because, interestingly, this article wasn't the basis for their motion for disqualification in the district court proceedings. If it was, they would, of course, have been required to file a motion in response to this article. Their motion wasn't in response to this article. They, in fact, my recollection is, and I wish I'd had the time, because I'm really largely hearing this for the first time because it's not in their briefs, I believe they sought affirmative relief from the district court after this article issued. I'll have to go back and double-check the record, but I'm pretty sure they did.
Mr. Vice, I have a simple question.
Yes.
The rule regarding judicial comments,
yes,
says that no judge shall comment on a pending or impending case.
Yes.
Does that, in your mind, strike that, does that, in your legal analysis, include commentary regarding litigants to a pending or impending case?
Well, what the rule says is Rule 210. And A says is that a judge shall not make public statements that might reasonably be expected to affect the outcome or impair the fairness of a matter pending or impending in any court, or make any non-public statement that might substantially interfere with the fair trial or hearing. That's sub A. All right? The judge, I know you are, Justice Sagan. The issue here is, in fact, the judge pointed out, and all the articles pointed out, when the judge was asked about this particular case or the litigants involved, the judge declined any comment. That's exactly what the judge was supposed to do. And by the way, sub E of our rules, 210, says, subject to the requirements of paragraph A, a judge may respond directly or through a third party to allegations in the media or elsewhere concerning the judge's conduct in a matter. And that, by the way, I think is somewhat relevant, as all of you will certainly recall, when questions were surfaced over some allegation that surfaced in a newspaper article about a federal investigation, members of this court responded to those allegations. There's nothing inappropriate whatsoever about this, what the district judge did in this case in response. And let's be clear about who it is that is generating and ginning up this media coverage. This litigant has been engaged in a campaign to smear my client for years. And the reason is that he needs to try and discredit my client on the claims that he has made and the federal investigations, three of them, that were launched as a result. Federal investigations, which, by the way, in his most recent deposition, which Mr. Allison tried to get this court to halt, he now lets stand behind many of his public pronouncements about how there would be no fire under the smoke that Mr. Jacobs was blowing, and how he would bet anyone a million to one. So anybody could win $1 billion by putting $1 billion on Mr. Jacobs' allegations. Mr. Allison now, under oath, says he won't stand behind those statements anymore. After he also testified in front of the district court at the jurisdictional hearing how the Department of Justice was going to exonerate him in the very near future. That was over a year ago.
Mr. Bice, my point, we're getting far afield from the issue that's in front of us. I'd like to focus on the sole question, and that is whether or not this court should entertain the writ, and if so, what order should enter as a result. Your description of discovery responses and a whole bunch of other stuff is really far afield. And while I appreciate the advocacy, I think we should focus on the issue. So let me pose my question.
All right, Justice Holmes.
Paragraph 16 of the judge's statement says, and this is in reference to a reporter's inquiry from the time,
yes,
to interview the judge. She says, since this did not deal with a case-specific issue, I returned his call told him I could not discuss any litigant or case, and answered his questions about my background, my view of the public nature of proceedings, and the long history of reporters from the RJ being present in my courtroom. During the telephonic interview, my judicial executive assistant, Dan Kutenik, the court public information officer, Marianne Price, and court staff counsel, Andre Moses, were present.
Yes.
When Mr. Sandberg asked questions about Mr. Adelson, I advised him I could not answer and discontinued the interview. Now, there is at least an acknowledgement on the part of the judge that she is engaged in an interview with a reporter, the interview of which was precipitated as a result of her conversation with the reporter in the courtroom on the subject matter. Doesn't this give rise to, on a disqualification motion, at least a hearing in front of the district court judge where Judge Barker, in this case, Chief Judge Barker, where the parties can further examine the identified witnesses, the judge in question, about what the contents of the conversation was? Now, from my former practice, if they brought in the reporter, the newspaper would probably tell them, assert the privilege and don't respond. But that aside, there does appear to at least be a potential contest on the question of what was discussed and what was the leading information that led up to that. My concern is this. When dealing with claims of disqualification against the judiciary, the test is whether or not the judge's behavior creates an appearance of impropriety. And so it is important for a transparent judiciary that this be thoroughly vetted and tested. Did Judge Barker abuse his discretion in not conducting a hearing over exactly what the conversations took place, and should he have made findings concerning that issue?
The answer to your question is no. In fact, Judge Barker did exactly what he should have done on this matter. And Justice Hardesty, the reason for that is very simple. Accepting even the statement in the article is absolutely true, which is, we cite the most Monsanto decision from the Alabama Supreme Court, which chronicles a lot of different cases, both the federal appellate courts and the state appellate courts on this issue. Probably the most comprehensive in terms of the number of the case law addressing it. And what the court there pointed out is, even accepting that statement in the article is true, there's nothing on the face of that that could give rise to a claim for disqualification. Because the judge specifically said, if you ask me about a particular case or a particular litigant, I'm not going to answer any questions about that. That was the end of it. And think about the consequences of the rule they are advocating and the question that you just posed. This will become the excuse du jour of every litigant who is now not getting their way in the district court, either by argument or trickery. In this particular case, to sabotage the district court proceedings. Because now, I'll just allege that there's bias, I'll make an allegation, I'll submit a declaration, and now I'm entitled to a hearing, I'm entitled to examine court staff, I'm entitled to examine the judge, and I'm entitled to bring the entire judicial machinery to a standstill so that I might try and smear the very person that is supposed to be deciding the case. And that is exactly what has
been
wanted.
I acknowledge that that's a legitimate concern, but it begins with a judge who themselves engages in a communication that would, on the surface, appear to be prohibited. And then the judge can prevent this if they just don't talk to reporters.
Well, Justice Hardesty, that's true, except the rules specifically allow a judge to respond to a reporter's inquiry, number one. And number two, the judge here didn't say anything that could be viewed as a violation of the rule, which is exactly Judge Barker's point, is on the face of their own allegations, accepting those allegations as true, there is nothing there. And that being the case, you're not entitled to try and derail the district court proceedings, which this litigant has been doing for years. This litigant had the audacity to tell the district court, Judge Barker, they sought to avoid this disqualification motion. They have been seeking a reassignment of this case for I have lost track of how many years they have been at this, trying to derail this case because they do not want a public trial and a public airing of what they did and what was really going on in Macau. And that is the problem here. They have been allowed to now try and gin up news media coverage on their own and ensnare people in the process, just like they smeared Mr. Jacobs and Justice Hudson. That's why I brought this point up about Mr. Allison's own comments. I think they are highly pertinent to the conduct of this litigant and what brings us to where we are at today. They have brought this, they have tried to gin this up to create the grounds for disqualification themselves, and then turn around and say, well, now, because we were out there maligning litigants, we want to now accuse the district court of some sort of bias because the district court responded to an inquiry from the media. And that inquiry was limited to general handling her background and general handling of cases. And when the specific case was raised, the judge said, I can't comment on that, which is exactly what the judge should have done. And that's exactly what she did too. So no, I think Judge Barker handled this absolutely correctly. On the face of their pleading, there was no basis for any form of evidentiary hearing of any sort, because even accepting the allegations that they claim as truthful about what was in the article would not give rise to judicial qualification. And that's why, under the abuse of discretion standard, he did not abuse his discretion in his handling of this matter. Now, I'm running out of time. I've asked the court for another minute to just make one additional point about this matter. Members of the court, this case is going to be 6 years old in very short order. There has been no trial. This litigant has brought this case down, again, through deception, a finding by the district court. The judiciary was deceived by this litigant, and trickery, and false claims of privilege. And I understand that those are harsh words, members of the court. I understand that, but they're also true words. So when this litigant tells us how the public confidence in the judicial process is at stake here, that's the one area where I have to agree with them. Because this process has been ground to a standstill by this intransigent litigant with unlimited resources, who is now simply, because he's not getting his way, has now turned his fire on the district court judge, and using his resources to try and derail the case through that mechanism because his prior requests of this court for recusal were denied. And I ask that that be denied again because this case is currently frozen again because of this conduct. I thank the court.
Mr. Jershowitz, I'll give you 2 minutes.
Well, thank you. 3 points to make. First, the other side says that we didn't raise this issue. If you look at PA 1990, we specifically raised the issue, cited all of the articles, and asked the court to, quote, abide by the NCJC's rules and not provide any comments about a case, et cetera, et cetera. So it's clearly protected by the record. As far as a hearing is concerned, we're not only did he deny us a hearing, he didn't even give us time to file a reply brief. He didn't give us an opportunity to even respond to the judge's affidavit. Normally, you get a chance to file a reply. So not only was there no evidentiary hearing, no oral argument, but he cut us off at the pass. We didn't even have a chance to respond to the judge's affidavit. We then submitted it after his judgment, specifically again asked for a hearing. Talk about witnesses. Of course the journalist may invoke privilege, and of course the judge may not want to test. There are third-party witnesses here. She herself created the witnesses. She put witnesses in the room. We're entitled to examine those witnesses and find out about the extent of the conversation that went both ways. And finally, they make a point that this will allow, and Your Honor, of course, responded fully, that they will allow every litigant to control the situation. It's just the opposite. The control is entirely in the hands of the judge. If the judge had not, A,
gone over and started a conversation with a journalist in the courtroom, B, recounted that conversation, C, gone on the record in an interview about a litigant that was going to be negative, knowing it would result in an article, we would not be here today. And what we're asking this court to do is to say to judges a simple order. It may be a little unclear now. You can't talk about the litigation, but you can talk about the litigant. No, you cannot talk about the litigation. You cannot talk about the litigant, and you cannot give an interview that you know is going to have an article about the litigant, particularly if you know the article is going to deal with the litigant in a negative way. That creates far too much of a danger that the public will perceive that the judges become an advocate, and the judges on one side of this litigation rather than objective. So a simple blanket rule that says no interviews would comport with what's being done now by the vast, vast majority of judges in this great state. And all we have to do is say, no judge should ever give an interview. That will avoid the problems. You won't have hearings. You won't have affidavits. But these judges will comply. Right now, judges are confused. They think they can speak about cases in which they're not going to, in which they have the usual disclaimer. We're not talking about the case. We're not going to talk about the issue. But we'll give you a
time, Mr. Dershowitz.
Thank you, sir. And I apologize, Your Honor, if I, in any way.
Justice Gibbons has a question.
Just one question, Mr. Dershowitz. I've been looking at Judge Gonzalez's declaration. She indicated that on January 6, 2016, she received a request from Josh Sandberg from Time for information on her background. I don't know from that if she knew what, if he was just calling about some innocuous information, it had nothing to do with the Las Vegas Sands case. Is anything, are we missing something here about how this came to pass? Because, I mean, that sounds like a question all of us get.
Sure. And your answer is very obvious. Talk to the court officers, court to the court clerks. They'll give you all the information. There's a resume online. You can look us all up. But then she starts the interview by saying, wow, let me tell you what happened in my courtroom.
When did she know, I mean, you may not know, but my curiosity is, when did she know that the subject matter of the interview was this case or Mr. Adelson?
The moment she told Time magazine about the interview in her courtroom, she determined what the article was going to be about because she said that. If she had just said, this would be a harder case. If she had just said, let me tell you, I grew up here, I do pro bono work. But no, she said in the interview, I want to tell you something that you should put in your article. And I'm telling you on the record, the boss, Adelson, instructed journalists to be in my courtroom. That made the article newsworthy. That made it a Time magazine. Do you think the Time magazine is going to rewrite an article about the background of a judge in Nevada? It's a national magazine. No, the national interest was what Sheldon Adelson may have told journalists in a newspaper that he was preparing to buy. So even if she didn't know, she determined the content of the article by giving them that on the record quote. And by any standard, that violates the rule in this state. Thank you, Your Honors. And again, I apologize if I tried to...
Any further questions? I just want to... You may sit down.
Thank you.
I know this has been a hotly contested matter and that there have been a number of pleadings filed, but I want to admonish counsel. We just recently engaged in a series of motions and pleadings about whether our orders meant what they said. I caution you to file against filing documents. We entered an order that denied a stay. We set this for argument. Case closed. We don't need motions being filed up here asking us, did we really mean what we said about our stay order? Am I clear about this?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case was closed.